Come closer. I want to talk to you. I'm going to tell you an astounding story. The story of the Maltese Falcon. 600 years, the Falcon has carried the mystery of a fabulous wealth under its grotesque wings. I could tell you a thousand tales of the men and women who have hunted this evil bird. But every story has the same ending. Murder. Listen to these incredible people, all consumed by their passionate greed for the Maltese Falcon.
Welcome to Celluloid Jelly. We're back. Episode 11.
Man, 11 episodes.
11 episodes.
Well into the double digits.
It's really two ones. Yeah. So we get our second chance at making a first impression here.
I guess.
I am your host, as always, CJ Talbot. And with me, my co-host,
Cesar Alejandro.
Junior,
yes.
Yes. Let's not forget that. Very important.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. Yes.
Hopefully you guys all listened to our last podcast on Logan.
Man, how long ago was that? 2 weeks ago? Not too far along.
Yeah, I posted about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, we're back. Again.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this episode's been a long time coming.
I'm giving you a hard time about this.
For a number of different reasons. of course, I guess some people know we're doing the Maltese Falcon this week. And but before that, I guess get some general stuff out of the way.
As we always do.
Yeah.
Well, I know you said you wanted to talk about something that you've been watching recently, but let's start.
I want to hear what you want to talk about. Having watched recently.
Let's start with some trailer talk. There were two major trailers dropped on us just over the past couple of days.
Were they?
Yes, indeed. the first one being the full trailer for Justice League. And I have not had a chance to talk to you about this yet.
Yeah, well, so, you posted something in the Celluloid Jelly forum, and I intentionally did not comment.
I posted the trailer and asked what people thought, and I got a pretty good response. Many of you put your comments down, and a lot of you are very much looking forward to the movie, and I'm really happy about that.
Did you put comments down yourself, or did you just post
I had a little, you know...
Because I didn't read anything.
Yeah, I had a little back and forth with some of the people who commented, notably Matt Weathers and I had a good conversation. So, hey, Matt.
Matt, this one's for you.
So, I think we, on a previous podcast, talked a little bit about Batman v Superman. So, let's start out with, how did you feel about this new Justice League trailer?
How did I feel about the new Justice League trailer? Well, to be honest, I guess there's a certain kind of, maybe malaise is the word I have when I hear about, a new DC film, or even generally, anything involved with Zack Snyder these days. I guess it was something I had to check out. I waited until close to the end of the day because I was working the day the trailer came out. I didn't want to watch it on a smaller television.
Yeah, me too. I posted it, I think it was 12 hours after it originally showed up, which was about 5 minutes after I watched it. Yeah. So,
overall, I mean, I have no idea what to think about what the movie's going to be because it kind of presents itself in a couple of different genres and tonally seems all over the place, which honestly may not be too far off considering the last Zack Snyder picture we all saw. There were a couple of scenes of some pretty cool visuals, some reveals. I didn't really look into any, any articles or videos that were analyzing the footage. I just kind of went with it. I've only seen the trailer twice myself personally. And
I watched it again an hour ago before coming over here.
I guess it's Justice League. There's some cool stuff, and a couple scenes seem like they were reflected for people who are comic book fans. But honestly, I'm not really sure, what to think about the film at all, considering the bad taste that's been left a mouth in the previous films.
As someone who has only minimal knowledge of like comic books and things like that, I have to tell you, I have no idea what the hell this movie is about. Now, I've talked to people. I understand, you know, obviously, the guy at the end of Batman Superman with the horns is Steppenwolf. So I assume he's the main villain of this movie. And those, what are they called, parademons, are his minions, or the minions of Darkseid, who Steppenwolf works for, or is he related to him?
General.
He's the general. Okay, yeah. So, but, you know,
who knows what they're going to use him as in the film.
Right. So there's no villain set up in the movie, but, you know, Steppenwolf was seen, I guess, communicating with Lex Luthor at the end of Batman v Superman. So we assume he's the bad guy.
Now, I mean, conversely, I guess, like when the Avengers, before it came out, I don't recall, because I guess maybe my memory is too short, but I don't remember if the trailers for Avengers really had. Well, aside from, I guess, the final trailer for it presented Loki as the villain, because I think the original ad campaign for it up until the, I guess the sequence with, Loki and Tony Stark about, you know, I have an army, I have a Hulk. Right. I don't think that bit was revealed until like one of the final trailers, maybe.
You might be right. I think the Avengers, whether it's fair or not, this is not a Marvel versus DC thing. It's the Avengers got there first. So with the Avengers movie, it was just pretty awesome to see these giant comic book personalities basically collide together in one movie and have to team up against anybody. Yeah, it didn't matter who it was. Like it was a first. Justice League does not have that advantage. We've already seen this movie from the Marvel side of things. So
done pretty well, too, and successfully.
Yeah, and so maybe it's not fair, but Justice League has to do it better. I think if you look at the Marvel movies, the Avengers movie is a very entertaining movie, but if you look at all 14 current Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, I don't think it's the best. Like, it may not even be in the top three. So, but Justice League has to be better because number one, it doesn't have the advantage of being first. Number two, they have not wowed anybody with what they've done yet. The Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, the Wonder Woman movie looks pretty good. Of course, that's not released till June.
Yes.
Right? You know, Justice League has got to nail this. You know, Warner Brothers has got, this is a multi-billion dollar franchise riding on this movie, essentially. You know, obviously.
I think the movie's going to be very successful regardless. Definitely, we all want it to be good, but I think this first full trailer doesn't, for me, it didn't really do much at all.
Yeah.
To get me excited. There were a couple visual scenes which I thought were pretty cool. I really dislike the way they're portraying Aquaman.
I've heard that from a couple people.
Yes. But like, for instance, there's a scene, I think, can't remember the name, Ezra Miller, who plays the Flash. You know, I think he might be a fine choice. I think he's a good young actor. There is a scene, like a short, maybe half a second sequence of the trailer where he's running and he does a sidestep, keeps on running and sidesteps back, which I thought was really cool.
Okay.
I kind of got the impression of maybe like, you know, like the 90 degree angle turns of like a Tron cycle, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. See that.
So I liked that visual, but I mean, you're talking about a trailer that was, you know, over 2 minutes, and that's like a second long scene, if that.
Yeah. I agree. Nothing wowed me about it. I'm a little disappointed that they keep going with these sort of bland, generic visual backdrops to the action scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a carryover from the blowback that they had from Man of Steel and the destruction of Metropolis and the idea that they didn't really address that in the film, because with Batman Superman, they sort of over-addressed it by mentioning 3-4 times that the place was abandoned where they fight Doomsday.
Even on the news, thankfully.
Yeah, like, thankfully, no one's there.
Thankfully, it's the end of the workday, so no one's working.
Right. So, but like, it looks like there's one shot in the new trailer where the Amazonians are fighting the the Parademons, which looks like a giant Lord of the Rings style action scene, which could be awesome, you know. But the rest of the action scenes that take place with, like Batman and Aquaman and Flash fighting Parademons all look like, I don't know where they are, but it doesn't look that interesting to me.
I think something that's kind of worrying is that, like, the scene that they use to end the trailer is Aquaman on the Batmobile.
And I almost just spit my tea out.
And jumping into, like, Parademons or something. Yeah. I was like, that's your big finale?
Right.
it's like,
and I love the look he gives Batman first.
Black Widow does that in the middle of the movie.
Right before that, like, he said, like, he gives out, like, a, it's not like a war cry, but like a woohoo kind of thing, like, because he's exhilarated by being on the Batmobile as it's going like 100 miles an hour or whatever, and he looks at Batman, and Batman turns and looks at him, and there's like a half smile, like, this is pretty cool, right? And then he jumps off, and I was like,
I'm glad someone thought it was cool.
Yeah, like, that had to be like one of the reshoots where they were like, come on guys, we need this to be fun, do something funny. Like, that's what they came up with.
Do anything.
Although I know people didn't like Aquaman being funny, but I do like the line where they're on the rooftop where the bat signal is, and Commissioner Gordon's like, it's nice to see you, you know, getting along well with others or something like that. And
or get along with others or working with other people again or something. Yeah. Along those lines.
And Aquaman goes, dressed like a bat, I dig it. And then Batman turns to Gordon and says, might be temporary. You know, like, I thought that was a good moment. Sure. That was a good laugh.
I think that's a moment that would not be out of place in, say, like, the Justice League animated series.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, and, you know, for a lot of people that's who don't read comic books, the animated series, you know, as part of, like, the Bruce Timm and Paul Dini animated universe, is probably most people's exposure to the Justice League characters.
Right, which is why they should do John Stewart, not Hal Jordan.
Well, even though they didn't, he's not in this film.
Well, we don't know that, but yeah.
Well, we're talking about the trailer, so.
Okay.
And at the same time, there's... I forgot what point I was going to make. Aquaman.
I'm sorry.
Aquaman is not in, he's not a regular member of the Justice League in the animated series. So honestly, the movie is probably serving to, like, work on Aquaman as a franchise going forward. And that's why he seems to be featured so heavily in promotion.
Sure. Well, that's the next big movie, right? They're just going to start shooting that soon with James Wan directing.
See, I would have thought they would have started it sooner, but... I guess if they're going to keep it going, you know, the train has to keep on going. But
yeah, well, if it comes out, they've got Wonder Woman, and then they've got Justice League, and then is there a DC movie next year?
Batman? Is that 2018?
No, that was pushed back, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because of the new director and everything?
Yeah. See, I think that's going to be bad to have, not Batman. It's going to be bad to have a delay in time where people can kind of forget about it.
Between Man of Steel and Batman v Superman, there was at least 3 years.
I guess so.
Yeah.
But I guess
2012 to 2016, was it 4 years?
No, 2013 or 2014. But Man of Steel was also, they weren't sure how they were going to move forward to that into a Justice League film until all the receipts had come in. Yeah. So they didn't start production.
Man of Steel, I think, is a better movie than Batman v Superman.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I'm not excited by what I see. It sounds like you're not excited by what you see. But, you know, I think anybody with any common sense knows that this is just an advertisement. It's just a trailer.
Sure.
It's, you know, not necessarily indicative of
what Plus, it's the very first. Be. It's the very first official trailer, too. So
I think that Comic-Con trailer was, you know, it was officially released. It didn't leak out. They released it. So that's, you know, I think that's their teaser, their first trailer. This is their second trailer.
I guess, the movie comes out in December.
Yeah. But, that was my thing. Like, today I rewatched both of those. And
rewatched
the first trailer that they did from Comic-Con is all about introducing the team. And the idea that Batman is kind of like being the Nick Fury and pulling these characters together.
Mm-hmm.
This new trailer just kind of like takes that same idea and doesn't do it as well as the first trailer did.
I don't
like. Well, I think it's just a poorly cut trailer.
I don't think the Comic-Con trailer was that good in the first place.
I think it had better moments in it than this trailer did, though.
Maybe.
Yeah. That's just my opinion.
I didn't rewatch it, so it's not fresh in my mind. But one of the things I was very kind of worried about, considering that was pretty much the only footage that we had really seen until this new trailer was released this week, was the fact that in that preview, Aquaman doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
And it's like a 4-minute trailer, if I'm right. Maybe not that long, but
he's on screen quite a bit, though.
Yeah, but it's
Bruce Wayne talking.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like, well, you hear Diana talking as well, but like, you know, Jason Momoa doesn't say a single thing in that original preview.
He's the muscle.
Yeah. Yes.
He's there to look good and take his shirt off for the ladies. That's what he's there for. All right, well, let's move on to the second big trailer, which I know you watched today, and that is Spider-Man Homecoming.
I did watch it today.
A vastly improved trailer than the first one, I thought.
I agree. The earlier trailer, just, you know, how long ago did that come out? Like, during summer, maybe. Was that right? No, it was probably in the fall, yeah?
Yeah.
3 or 4 months ago?
Yeah.
You might have to refresh me because I watched it very early this morning.
Okay.
And I probably only saw it once. So I wish I, you know, I guess I probably should have watched it again.
You want me to pause this so you can watch it?
Before we record it? No. Stream of consciousness. Let's get this.
I didn't care for any of the action in the first trailer, and I thought the action featured in this trailer was much more dynamic and was truer to the character of Spider-Man. So a lot more flips in the air, a lot more swinging from side to side. And I love that, the two moments in the trailer specifically, the one where the camera is behind a group of people on a building, and you just see Spider-Man kind of like pop up from swinging on his web.
Yeah, that's straight out of the panel.
Right, and he says, "Hey guys," and then like goes right back out of frame again. Like, beautiful moment. That made me chuckle. It was really well done. And then later, as Tony Stark is telling him to just be your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, he's like going through a bunch of tree branches and swings down into a pool and says cannonball and goes right back out. And like the people who are around the pool get all splashed and wet, and they don't, it's almost like they don't even see him. Like, it's just like a complete and total surprise. Mm-hmm. So I thought both of those were really good moments. This also featured a little bit more Vulture than the last one, mm-hmm. and you get a little Michael Keaton action.
Yeah, Batman, Birdman, the Vulture.
Yeah. He's no stranger to superhero characters.
One of the things I'm very glad that they included in this film is that, which they kind of have a little bit in the last preview, but not a lot. But one of the things I'm a big fan of in superhero films is a scene where there's a rescue. Because I always think, because I always think that's one of the most important things of, you know, a hero, especially, you know, sacrificing themselves, even though in this trailer, it kind of shows that that's not necessarily the best end result on what he does. You know, this film had the bit where I guess there's a fairy that's been split in half and he's holding it together with his body, which is not unreminiscent of Spider-Man 2.
With the train.
The look of it, considering all the webs and him, you know, his body's the connection.
Right.
They also do that in Amazing Spider-Man 2 during the, I guess, the electric dam reservoir sequence when he's holding electricity together against the
fighting electric. I've probably forgotten half of that.
Probably. It sounds like it. Based, you can't see it, folks, but he's had a bit of a dumbfounded look.
Scratching my temple, trying to figure it out.
Yeah. But yeah, the rescue scenes in movies, I think, are amongst my favorite bits of a film because they have to show for a character like Spider-Man specifically, you know, who doesn't have speed and he's not the strongest character that's out there, ingenuity in a way to utilize his powers to get this done. I think, conversely, the Justice League, obviously, they set out from the get-go that they're teaming up to fight something.
Right.
But, you know, so their goal may be different. Who knows? I'm sure there'll be people getting rescued.
Right.
But like Spider-Man, that's his thing.
Yeah, he's just there to make a difference.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think I like that point a lot. And I think maybe a lot of people haven't articulated it in that manner. But I think that's the problem with a lot of the superhero movies in general, is that it's super-powered good people fighting, in many cases, super-powered bad people, but it's not always about somebody being heroic and saving the ordinary person. So
yeah, I think Spider-Man, I mean, most people who know me, I know some people who listen to this podcast know this about me already, but Spider-Man is my favorite superhero character, bar none. And then, you know, Superman's my number two. And I think both of them share this characteristic.
Sure.
Especially in the films, I think.
Yeah, that moral virtues.
Man of Steel to a lesser degree, probably.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean...
They're going to correct that, though, Cesar.
We'll see.
Apparently, when Superman comes back from the dead, he'll be the Superman we all love.
As long as he has a superhero mullet, again.
And, well, I've seen pictures of him in that black suit with the silver shield.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I hope they don't actually use that in the movie.
We'll see. I mean, that could just be a suit that'll be, like, maybe color corrected.
I hope so, because, like...
That could just be his burial shroud, though, you know?
They took, you know, Superman character that was, you know, brightly colored and stood up for truth, justice, and all the rest. and they turned him into a bit of a darker character, a little...
I liked your Superman Returns reference.
Yes, I did that just for you.
And I got it. I understood.
There's going to be another Superman reference later when we talk about Maltese Falcon, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Do you know what it is?
Mm.
You might not have caught it.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, we'll get there. Don't worry. But anyway, so yeah, that's the one thing we want is to see the Man of Steel Superman even darker and more bleak. Thanks. Thanks, Zack Snyder.
Well, I mean, I understand like the rationale with DC, you know, going in a direction for their films, which is darker. I certainly don't think that copying what Marvel is doing is gonna work out the same way, considering their characters tend to be quite different comparatively within their pantheon.
Absolutely.
So going a different direction is a good idea for them. They just need to execute and make better films.
Yeah.
You know, this is just a trailer, so who knows? I do think Wonder Woman looks quite good.
Yeah.
Honestly, and that looks quite a bit lighter, but maybe it works a little bit better.
And this is off top. Well, it's not really off topic, but it's tangential to our conversation about these two trailers. But in the Wonder Woman movie, the actress who plays the bad guy is the actress from is it The Skin I Live In?
I have not seen that picture.
The Pedro Almodovar.
You talking about Poison?
Movie. No, it's her and Antonio Banderas, where he's a crazy doctor who...
I'm familiar with the film. I've never seen it, though.
Okay, well, she's gorgeous.
She's the one who plays Dr. Poison.
What?
Dr. Poison, with, like, the mask on her face.
Dr. Poison?
Never mind.
Okay.
The one who poisons, like, American soldiers. She's, like, well, old character. World War II, though, but...
Are you talking about in the Wonder Woman movie?
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I'm asking. Is like she's got a scar on her face in the movie, and they barely have shown her at all. But like, do you know who she's playing?
Yeah,
that's Dr. Poison.
Yeah, it's Poison. Poison's in the name. I can't remember if like her title is Doctor or not, though. But like, she's a character, really old character that, and like during World War II, she poisoned like, military servicemen and stuff. That was kind of her thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess back then you just needed like a serial killer gimmick as opposed to actually like superpowers to compete against Wonder Woman. She was quite a bit weaker back then originally.
Okay.
Anyway,
getting back to Spider-Man Homecoming, I'm much more enthusiastic about that movie than I was after the first trailer. So they did it right. They put a teaser out there, and then they put another trailer out there that actually, makes me want to see the movie, even though I would have seen it anyway, because that's the kind of movie watcher I am, you know, audience member. But I think, you know, the average person who's like, you know, I've seen 5 Spider-Man movies already and Civil War, like, why do I need another Spider-Man movie in my life? I think this one makes the case for it.
I think while I like the trailer, I also kind of feel that the trailer hits the beats of the entire film, though.
I that's funny you say that, because I was just gonna say that's the one criticism that the two people that I've talked to about the trailer today Both of them had mentioned, I feel like I see the whole movie now.
Well, they know what they're talking about. I mean, who knows how shortly after this takes place following the events of Civil War. I've read an article that suggested that each film takes place the same amount of time in between films from the previous picture. Yeah. So you can assume that this film takes place, you know, I guess a year or, you know, over a year after the events of Civil War.
That seems like a long time.
It does.
Yeah. But, I mean, that I'm not saying you're wrong. It just seems like a long time, especially when, well, I guess Doctor Strange takes place after Civil War too. And then you're going to have Spider-Man Homecoming and you're going to have Thor Ragnarok before Infinity Wars or Infinity War or Infinity Gauntlet or whatever the hell they're calling
Avengers
it.
Avengers
3. Yes.
Avengers Tokyo Drift.
All right. Cool. All right. Well, you mentioned that you wanted to talk about a movie that you had seen recently before we get into our Maltese Falcon discussion. What was that?
Well, actually, two films.
Two films.
It was a two film series.
Buckle your seatbelts, Fast and Furious fans.
Well, it tells one story, but it's a two film series that was released about a month apart from each other in 2016. Japanese pair of films, which are based on a manga, which has also been a very successful Japanese animated series called Chihayafuru. Now, the director is a guy who I'm not really familiar with. He's a pretty young guy, but these movies were among the most successful movies released in 2016 financially and like as critically acclaimed, even though they're more mainstream than say some of the more award bait type of films that get released. It's about Chihayafuru is about there's a three friends who, when they were kids, they became close because they played a traditional Japanese game called Karuta, which is a card game where it uses, they're called like the 100 poems, which is the 100 greatest classical Japanese poems, where cards have the second verse of a famous poem written on them. They're laid out in front of two competing players, while a third person reads the first verse to a card. Whoever captures the second card that goes with the first verse wins that card, and it's competition for points and cards.
Okay.
Basically, these three kids, while they were young, they became very close. Two boys and one girl. So I guess you can expect a love triangle going to develop into this. But basically, one of them has to leave. The guy who taught both of them how to play competitively.
Okay.
Fast forward years later, you know, they'd made a promise to continue to play, and eventually they'd meet each other again. So fast forward years later, the girl, she keeps on playing.
How old are they when they...
When they're kids, you're talking, gosh, I want to say like first grade, so maybe 8 or 9 or something. And it fast forwards to them in high school.
Okay. That seems old for first grade, but
I don't know.
Does that work differently in Japan?
I don't know. No, probably not. Okay. So first grade is like what, 6 or 7?
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. Yes, 7.
Okay. And then fast forward to
high school.
Okay, so 15, 16?
Maybe? Yeah. Okay. It's I would say it's probably pretty close to
this
the same.
This is probably not as important as I'm making
it. It isn't.
Go ahead.
Long enough that they're played by different actors at this point.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Okay. So fast forward, and the girl has kept up with her promise. One of the friends who has still stayed kind of local, but they haven't been as close, they are now in the same school. And he reluctantly joins a club that she's starting for that. They get teammates and everything in order to compete. Because if they play in a team tournament, they can meet him, which is because he's so far away. In a different prefecture.
Okay.
So basically, they play and compete and get better, but it uses a couple different very interesting things to kind of tell the story, which, you know, at its core is mostly about friendship, competition, and the things that tie people together.
Okay. I'm getting that this is a drama, though, right?
Well, there are bits of comedy, and honestly, like the time when they played the competitive Karuta is actually very exciting. I was surprised at how invested I was in the game. Personally, I did not really like, I mean, I know how to play, I've learned how to play the game, but the intricacies of it escape me. But they're presented in a way that when you're watching other people compete competitively is pretty astounding.
Okay.
So they get, I guess they're competing, what's my frame of thought, a little bit. Okay, so they're competing in order to meet him, but it uses, because the game is centered around poems, the trials that they experience can be kind of overcome by learning the true meaning of poems or interpretations of poems.
Okay.
So there's a guy, the films have a very beautiful kind of, I guess like, culturally relevant example about like Japanese, you know, bit of Japanese culture that exists. And it could be more of like the mentality and the dedication to be good at a single thing, which to some people being good at a game like this would be almost like innocuous, but for them it's very important because it's a promise.
Okay.
So within the two films, you know, there's a lot of fun moments because there's quite a bit of comedy in it.
Is it sort of broken in half, like a part one, part two?
It is.
Or, okay. Yeah. All right.
So now it was very successful. The young girl who's the star of the film, she might be considered like kind of like the big young actress working today. An actress by the name of Hirose Suzu. And I think in the United States, she's probably really like not well known. She was in a film called Our Little Sister, directed by Hirokazu Koreeda, who is a Cannes Film Festival winner for Best Director.
Was that 2 years ago?
He won for Nobody Knows, which was 2004.
Okay.
And his young actor there won Best Actor.
That sounds familiar to me, though, Our Little Sister. So, like, was it recent?
Maybe a year or two ago.
Okay.
2014, I might, that might be off. So she plays the little sister in that movie.
The titular character.
Yeah, I guess. and, you know, she's quite good in that film as a young actress, but I guess she's kind of experienced an explosion of popularity. And, you know, based on these two films, it's very well deserved.
Is it common in Japan for them to sequelize stories like this? Or was this perhaps based on, was it based on a novel or...
You mean Chihaya Furu?
Yeah.
Well, it's based on a manga series.
Okay, all right. Yeah. You did say that. I apologize.
Yeah, so basically, it is quite uncommon, though I think I've seen a trend where they're doing like film series consecutively. In the United States, it's not so uncommon, especially these days. But, you know, you had stuff
that,
like...
That was going to be the next...
Attack on Titan or Rurouni Kenshin are good examples.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that a re... Sorry.
Recent development?
No. I was going to say, is that a result of the success seen in Hollywood with breaking up things like Hunger Games, Divergent, and Twilight into like multiple parts and
you know,
especially like the longer books doing the last part in two movies or...
You know, I can't say for sure. I do know it was originally conceived as two films, but they are starting shooting on a third one.
Okay.
Which, you know, I think these two films, they begin and end perfectly. The third one, I guess, is probably going to take place during a gap that exists because the two films are kind of bookend by a future sequence.
Okay.
And it kind of jumps backwards. But there's quite a bit of time that doesn't exist, you know, within the two films as released.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm
Did you write a review for the website?
I did write reviews for both of them, but they haven't gotten up yet. I'm sure by the time this thing gets posted, they'll be up. So
awesome. So we'll put a link to them in the show notes.
Yeah, I think they're probably going up sometime within the next 5 days. I wrote them, but they were scheduled, so I didn't actually post them, but they're finalized already.
Cool. All right, awesome.
I like these movies a lot, guys, so... I've been listening to the soundtrack in my car, like, repeatedly. It just cycles, like, all the scenes of the film in my head. Very beautiful score.
Sweet. Have to check it out. Definitely. All right.
How about you? What have you watched recently?
Nothing.
After hearing me babble about a Japanese film.
I have not seen a movie theatrically since Beauty and the Beast. I'm a slacker.
I gotta say, me too. I haven't seen King Kong. I haven't seen Power Rangers. I thought
Kong Skull Island was fun.
Inexplicably, I do have a little bit of time off this week, so I can. I'm gonna aim to, knock some of those off my to watch list.
I need to see the Belko Experiment. I need to see Power Rangers. I need to see. Oh, what else is
out? I'm very happy that a lot of people I know who've seen Power Rangers have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Which is, people were very worried about it, as was I.
But I would never have seen Power Rangers, and I haven't yet, but I'm planning to do it now because so many people have told me that they liked it so much. But I thought the trailers looked...
I think they looked horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say average at best.
It kind of looked like Chronicle...
Yeah, Chronicle meets Power Rangers.
Power Rangers.
Yeah.
That's a kind of sterling discussion you guys get. Anyway, Joey, gotta work on our similes and metaphors.
Well, I was yawning and Cesar picked up the slack there, so I appreciate that.
And don't get bored at our own discussions.
I'm not bored. It's late at night. I apologize. I'm an old man,
Yeah.
It's past my bedtime. But I saw Beauty and the Beast. I've watched a few things at home. I rewatched, a couple of, film noirs, since, watching Maltese Falcon recently has got me back on a noir kick.
Yeah.
So I watched, the Dark Corner, which actually features Lucille Ball as a private detective's, secretary, who falls in love with the private detective and helps him out on his case, which I thought was good. Not great, but good. I liked that one. I rewatched Kiss Me Deadly, which is one of the landmark 1950s noir films, a product of the Cold War, the Atomic Age, and I really enjoy that movie. And the ending, of course, is one of the reasons why it's so iconic. And have you ever seen Kiss Me Deadly?
Hmm.
Kiss Me Deadly.
I have to say, film noir is a pretty big hole in my, my history of watching.
Everybody's is like Swiss cheese. Nobody has it all. That's all right. But for those of you who have not seen it, I guess I won't spoil it. But one of the most famous Steven Spielberg films gets. Its ending, or at least was influenced heavily by the ending of Kiss Me Deadly. So those of you who have seen it know exactly what I'm talking about, and those of you who haven't should probably watch Kiss Me Deadly.
So what you're saying is someone gets put into a warehouse?
I'm saying Mike Hammer gets taken back in the alien spacecraft after he phones home.
Does a T-Rex come in and save him at the last minute?
Yes. He outwits a velociraptor by hiding in the kitchen cabinet.
Clever girl.
Yeah. And a few others. I watched I Wake Up Screaming, which actually came out the same year that The Maltese Falcon, our film of discussion today. Coming from a different studio, the same year The Maltese Falcon came out. And Maltese Falcon is generally considered to be the first fully formed American film noir, and all the previous dark melodramas and gangster movies and crime pictures that preceded it are simply referred to by academics as the precursors to the film noir genre, and Maltese Falcon is the movie that apparently is ground zero for kicking off the movement. Whether you consider it a genre or whether you consider it a style, this is the granddaddy of them all. But I Wake Up Screaming came out the same year, is never given any credit for helping to kick that off as well, but has some amazing cinematography in it, low contrast lighting, canted camera angles, desperate characters. So I enjoyed that quite a bit. It stars Victor Mature. But that's a good a good way to maybe get into our Maltese Falcon discussion here. This was a first time watch for you. I'm just going to run down real quick. Hopefully most of you have seen Maltese Falcon. If not, you may want to pause this. We're 40 minutes into the podcast already. Just starting. It's going to be a long one.
I'm going to have to, leave it to you to correct me on like the character names and stuff. Though I'm pretty sure I have a good handle on them.
Well, I did take the liberty of, which I do for every podcast, just so that I get the actors' names right. That is like I kind of wrote a cast list down, but to be honest, for this movie, I really didn't need it. In fact, I did most of this by memory and not looking it up on like IMDb or anything. But Maltese Falcon, made 1941. Warner Brothers Pictures, directed by John Huston. This was actually John Huston's first movie as a director. He had previously written screenplays for a bunch of movies, including High Sierra, which starred Humphrey Bogart and came out the same year. The screenplay is credited to Huston, which is, of course, based on the novel by Dashiell Hammett, and is Dashiell Hammett, not Dashiell Hammett. Dashiell Hammett, coincidentally, was born in Maryland and worked as a real detective for the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And was stabbed at least once on duty.
Like Nicholas Angel?
Yeah. And once he stopped being a detective, moved to San Francisco and worked in the art world and at a jewelry store, actually, more specifically, which is probably where the idea of a jewel-encrusted bird from Malta came from. Of course, the movie stars Humphrey Bogart, Mary Astor, Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, Lee Patrick, Elisha Cook Jr., who is very famous for many of his film noir roles and also appears with Bogart in The Big Sleep. Again, this was a first-time watch for you, so what did you think? Just general reaction.
It's a pretty damn good movie.
Okay. All right. Anything specifically kind of strike you that you want to use as a jumping off point? Or?
The movie itself, as is, I guess, kind of common with a lot of films from this period, it tends to use a lot of, they're very dialogue heavy.
Sure.
So, like, the movie is very dense with material. And, you know, I think it covers, I mean, I've never read the book that it's an adaptation of, but dialogue comes pistol quick, like it's rapid fire.
Yeah, especially from Spade.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think also, I mean, there are quite a bit of, I guess, which at this in this day and age they'd be considered kind of like stereotyped, like colloquialisms, especially with the way he talks. But back then, I guess I imagine it was pretty common, though who knows if it was just movie talk or not.
Well, I mean, the Maltese Falcon, Hammett wrote, pulp novels. He was one of the big few writers who did hard-boiled detective fiction. This is a movie that kind of took... he wrote this before he wrote The Thin Man, but previous movies that featured detectives, in a lot of cases, detectives were police officers, not private investigators, or sort of like highfalutin, upper crust society type.
I love that
well educated.
Highfalutin.
Yeah.
Highfalutin.
So, I mean, one of the reasons why Maltese Falcon is considered to be, one of the first, if not the first film noir is because it's the first great example of detective work being portrayed as sort of ground level, dirty, work that, not glamorous in any way.
I just nodded.
Yeah.
With you guys.
And you had mentioned that the dialogue is quick and it's very dialogue heavy. And that was certainly just a hallmark of that era of, pulp fiction. by the time Raymond Chandler became famous for writing Philip Marlowe novels, you know, his books were all about the dialogue. There weren't a lot of scene descriptions and things like that the way, but you know, Hammett did. Hammett would, you know, not nearly as bad as like Tolkien, but Hammett would certainly describe things in a more not flowery language, but certainly he would throw a lot more descriptors in there.
Have you read the book?
I read The Maltese Falcon like back in college, but it's been like 20 years, so yeah. In the book, Sam Spade is a blonde guy who's very thin, described as being like very angular face, almost like V-shaped.
Like a praying mantis?
I guess so.
I just thought of a praying mantis with blonde hair.
Yeah, yeah, Bogart fits that description perfectly. Yeah,
Kafka.
But, you know, aside from that, they typically stick fairly well to the source material, which is one of the big things. I don't know if you knew this. Certainly anybody out there who's listening to this can IMDb or Google this, but this was the third attempt at making a movie out of The Maltese Falcon. In 1931, they made a film called The Maltese Falcon. It did not do well. It was a box office failure. It did not get on the radar of many people. A few years after that, in I think it was 36, they did a movie called Satan Met a Lady. And Satan being the Spade character, although they changed the names to all the characters because they didn't want it to be quote-unquote a remake of The Maltese Falcon, which was not a success. So they called it Satan Met a Lady, but Satan referred to how he was described in the text. A blonde Satan, essentially. And it was, instead of a drama, it was turned into a comedy. And the Bridget O'Shaughnessy character, played by Mary Astor in this version with Humphrey Bogart, was played by Bette Davis in Satan Met a Lady.
Have you seen Satan Met a Lady?
No, I have not. To be honest, I tried to track down a copy on DVD, but I would have had to order it online. I couldn't get it
in time for this.
Yeah. But I was going to watch all three films. I did listen to the radio drama, which was done Mary Astor, Peter Lorre, Humphrey Bogart, and I think Sidney Greenstreet reprised his role as well. They did have other characters played by different actors.
Yeah, good voice.
Yeah. The radio play was a very similar but extremely truncated. So I think the radio play was 30 to 40 minutes, something like that. So they combine a couple of things in some scenes and cut out a bunch of stuff as well. Getting back to the Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart, directed by John Huston, is the third attempt at bringing Hammett's book onto the screen. And I had mentioned earlier that it was more faithful to the text. And there's a little bit of a funny story. Huston apparently told Howard Hawks that he wanted to do The Maltese Falcon. And Hawks famously just told him to go back to the original book and just shoot the book. Like, don't try to rewrite it. Don't try to disguise it. Don't try to do anything. Just, like, literally shoot the book because the book is great. So Huston apparently got the book, gave the book to his secretary, and said, just type this up in script form, don't do anything else. And he went on vacation. And before he came back, I can't remember if it's Jack Warner or Hal Wallace, but one of the two of them, I think it was Jack Warner, walked into the office and grabbed the screenplay that was just typed up from the novel off the desk and greenlit it from that, before Huston ever had a chance to just read it.
So Huston also has a screenwriting credit for this, huh?
Yes. Well, the final line that Bogart has, the stuff that dreams are made of, is not in the book. It was something that Huston came up with. So
that's a pretty enduring line. So I didn't realize it was from this film.
Yeah. So he, you know, he deserves that screenplay credit for that one line of dialogue.
What's the name of the secretary?
Yeah, I don't know.
Princess, huh? Her name is Princess.
Her name's John Huston.
Princess Angel.
But the movie does create one scene sort of whole cloth. The scene where we see Miles Archer get killed is not in the book at all.
So you have that little quick shot of him being...
Yeah, so, well, it starts with the point of view shot of the gun.
Yeah, I can't remember. He has his back turned, he turns around.
Yeah,
and
the gun gets raised up, and it's one of the first examples of a filmmaker putting the audience into the shoes of a killer in, through a first-person perspective. So it's sort of innovative in that way. Huston was never given a ton of credit for being a great technical director, but he certainly was. And there's a lot of great technical work done in The Maltese Falcon, a lot of nice dollies and zooms and things like that. It's not a flashy movie the way that Citizen Kane was, which was made the same year. And certainly, Orson Welles's dynamic approach to the storytelling and just his artistic virtuosity is something that is, you know, highly regarded, and that's one of the greatest, you know, movies ever made. Huston doesn't get that type of a credit as an artist the way that Welles does. But certainly I think if you really look at this film, especially if you watch the Blu-ray and you know, look at the way camera moves are mapped out and the way scenes transition, Huston really knew what the hell he was doing.
Yeah, I guess in particular, I guess the scene in O'Shaughnessy's like room, hotel room, but I guess at the time she was still just Wenderley.
Okay.
Where it goes in and I guess she's doing her bit. And
yeah.
The camera goes sweeps left and right, eventually, she sits down to face Spade. And the camera zooms in, but it's like a pretty long continuous shot, maybe 2 or 3 minutes. So it's pretty interesting, especially, you know, consider it's from 41.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. I think the acting's really good in the movie, just because you were mentioning Miss Wonderly. I am not a huge fan of Mary Astor. And I think it's no wonder when they sort of reassembled this cast for Casablanca. A year later, that they sort of upgraded their talent level with Ingrid Bergman.
Well, she's also she's also an actress who had a lot of history in, I guess, silent film too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure a lot of her acting is a holdover from, you know, the more, you know, exuberant kind of physical acting that exists in there. One thing I did like, though, which, you know, at the beginning of the film, as someone who hadn't seen it before, you know, there's... I guess when she first appears in Sam's and Miles' office,
yeah.
When she's telling, you know, her story, her case to Sam, you know, she makes a very it's a very noticeable point of when she's telling her story, she's never looking at him.
Yes, until she doesn't look anybody in the eye.
Yeah, until like in that scene specifically, she does turn to look at Sam during moments when she mentions Thurman or what's the name.
Thursby.
Floyd, yeah. Thursby. Well, every time she mentions Thursby, she looks at him.
Yeah.
So, like, that's one thing I noticed, like, right away.
Yeah. No, I mean, what she does in the movie, she does well. But...
There's a kind of, like, there, OD, overdramatic
bit. Yeah, if you compare her performance to Peter Lorre, Sidney Greenstreet, or Bogart, like, she's... I think she's the weak link of the bunch.
I mean, it's
but I don't think you can say the same thing about Bergman and Casablanca, mm-hmm. You know, and that's maybe not a fair comparison, but too bad, you know, but I do like, the one scene I really do like her in though, is the scene where, she sees Joel Cairo for the first time since Europe. So when Sam sets up their meeting, at his place and, she's there and Cairo comes in and she's kind of doing her little damsel thing for Sam Spade. And then when Joel comes in, she becomes much more relaxed and in control. she's got the power in that situation against Joel Cairo, where she doesn't necessarily have the power against Sam Spade. So she plays two different characters in that scene, essentially. And I do really like that scene as a result of it.
Well, you can tell it totally changes with, like, her body posture.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you see her, maybe not slouch, but, like, she kind of, in that, I guess, the armchair, yeah. When they both take a seat, and Sam sits in between them from our perspective.
Yeah, and she's, like, the rest of the time, she's just kind of playing up the whole thing, like, the whole damsel in distress thing, you know, like, I need a man to help me, I need a man to protect me, be kind to me, Mr. Spade, you know,
to be honest, I do
her on it a bunch of times.
I do like the ending to this quite a bit.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah, but I love that Sam calls her on it constantly. He sees through her, and he allows himself to be
swayed.
Well, manipulated and seduced. He's willingly seduced. You know, he's looking for a little bit of action, and you can tell, like, the Spade character in general is a man of action. He's not. There's a big difference between the character of, like, Sam Spade and the character of, like, Philip Marlowe, whereas Spade is sort of a. Like, he figures things out as he goes along, and Marlowe's the type of character that kind of just sits there and thinks about things and works through things ahead of time. And Spade is much more unpredictable.
Yeah, they make a point of saying that about him. The multiple characters do during the film.
Yeah, Gutman especially. And I love Sidney Greenstreet. And this was his first major movie. And then he had a whole career basically playing this kind of person. You know, for Warner Brothers.
Semi-aristocrat.
Yeah, well, but like, he plays in Casablanca as sort of like the... it's sort of a jolly shyster, I guess, almost. Like
jolly shyster.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's a beardless Santa Claus
if
will take you for
if,
every penny.
If Santa Claus was the con man.
that's what it is.
It's the biggest con of them all, Santa
and then
Claus.
He and Peter Lorre actually reunite a few years after that. I think it's 1944, 1945, or something like that, for a movie called Mask of Demetrios, which is another noirish type movie.
I'm definitely going to default to you when it comes to noir, because I know that's one of your big...
Well, it's something that I love. I wouldn't call myself an expert or anything like that, but I do tend to watch
certainly
quite
a bit
few.
More than I, yeah. than I am.
But I mean, you know, the acting is top-notch in this movie, and if you haven't seen this movie and you're listening to this podcast, I think if somebody said, why should I watch The Maltese Falcon, I would probably give you... a bunch of different reasons, but I would say that, like,
it's considered one of the greatest American films.
Well, and this cast together playing off one another, you know, doing this dialogue that Hammett wrote, is certainly one of the major reasons to see it. You know, if you're interested in the history of film, you know, then sure, you know, you can look at it as a very important landmark film in noir. You can look at it as a landmark film in the career of Humphrey Bogart as well, who, really, this was the first time he had ever played the hero, quote unquote, of a movie. He was bouncing around playing, B-grade gangsters.
He was a contract guy for Warner Brothers, though, at that time, right?
Yeah. Well, he still was after this movie, but he became a star with this film. The movie that I mentioned earlier, which was written by John Huston but not directed by him, High Sierra, was really the first time Bogart had the lead, top billing in a movie. And that movie is quite good as well. But this movie made him a star. This movie made him a viable top liner with audiences. And then Casablanca sealed the deal. It's funny because you know who George Raft is?
I do
the
know.
Actor George Raft.
Yeah, he's
he's another like tough guy, sort of Edward G. Robinson type character. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, a lot of the different roles that Bogart got that made his career, High Sierra, Maltese Falcon, and Casablanca, were all offered to George Raft before given to Humphrey Bogart, and he turned them all down. So it basically,
I'm sorry, I don't know who George Raft is.
Humphrey Bogart owes his entire career to George Raft, essentially. Yeah. So
who?
Exactly. Now, George Raft has been in a lot of big movies. And he's actually in I think one of the most interesting film noir films, if I can make a 30-second digression here. He's in a movie called Red Light, where he is trying to get revenge on his brother being killed. His brother was a priest, and there's like a missing Bible that he's trying to track down. And it's an interesting movie because it's sort of got that dark film noir tone and look, but it also has like a real strong religious overtone to it, which is just something that you wouldn't think would go together. And maybe a lot of people, you know, who are big into film noir, maybe that's one of the knocks on the film, is that they don't mesh together. But I think it's fascinating for that reason. So if you like George Raft, check out Red Light.
Who?
Yeah. So do you have any favorite moments from the film?
Well, I like the ending a lot, but I guess we can get
to the ending's so good.
Let's see. I honestly like all the moments when Sam is kind of clowning on Wilmer.
Oh, yeah.
He's just, you know, the kid, they call him the boy. He's like so kind of like underclassed against like Sam Spade's character.
Yeah. Well, you get the sense that he doesn't really look that much younger than Humphrey Bogart. Mm-hmm. But you get the sense that he's supposed to be the up and coming kid who's just kind of learning the ropes, and Spade's been around the block a bunch of times. Yeah. So he just knows all the tricks. Yeah.
Chip on the shoulder.
Yeah. And so maybe 5 years later, you know, Wilmer is a different version of Sam Spade.
Seven Samurai. To Toshiro Mifune.
Right. but yeah, it's kind of funny.
He's not.
I don't know. Because I couldn't claim to be an expert. But like, obviously the Joel Cairo character is supposed to be based on a character in the book who is homosexual. And in the movie, they skirt around that quite a bit, but they definitely use some phallic references, the way he handles his cane when he goes in to see Spade the first time.
Yeah.
And he seems to be a bit soft or effete.
Kind of a dandy.
Yeah. So I think they obviously were smart, and they had the production code at the time, so they couldn't have done it anyway, but they couldn't be, overt about it. But the Sidney Greenstreet character, the Wilmer character, is sort of like a body man who kind of runs all of his errands and does everything for him. And Bogart refers to him, the Sam Spade character refers to him as a gunsel, which doesn't mean what you would think it meant. It doesn't mean like a gunman. It essentially means sort of like a kept boy. It's basically a slant, you know, that he's, you know, doing a little bit too much for Sidney Greenstreet, which is one of the reasons why he's so infuriated when that happens. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, Spade knows how to, manipulate with the best of them. And all these characters are highly duplicitous. I love that, Casper Gutman, I get the sense that he is always sort of a little bit smarter than everybody else, that he takes pride in being smarter than everybody else, and he certainly seems more educated than Spade, but he seems delighted that Spade is at least his equal in street smarts, and that he doesn't get that very often, and I think that's why he's so delighted, you know, by Spade. And in a different situation, maybe Gutman kills Spade instead of just like, maybe they poison him instead of
drugging him,
you know, or maybe he shoots him.
If that level of respect wasn't like achieved.
Yeah, absolutely.
If he didn't see Sam as judicious.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite lines. Is
well, he says it like during that exchange. He says it 3 or 4 times. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, are you a closed mouth man? And he's like, no, I like to talk. He's like, better and better. I just like a closed mouth man. They generally pick the wrong time to speak and say the wrong things when they do. And talking is something one can do judiciously only if one keeps in practice.
Well, I think that might be a good thing to consider for the podcast situation.
And so he's like, yeah, exactly. Thank you. And so he's like, and then right after that, he's like, so I tell you straight out, I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to talk. And I love that line. That kind of like dialogue always tickles me a little bit.
One thing, I know we were just talking about like favorite scenes, something that just kind of came to me is, you know, one of the big, I guess like promotional, images in the posters is, Sam holding a pistol, with like smoke coming out of the barrel. That doesn't happen in the film. No. I don't think you ever see a gun go off on screen.
You do.
Aside from,
when Miles gets
shot. Miles murder, but that's it though. Yeah.
Yep.
So it's a lie. Well, advertising's a lie.
It's funny because, you know, if you've seen the movie, and spoiler alert here, it's a 70, it came out in 1941, right? So it's a 76-year-old movie this year. The angle with which the gun, it's pointed downward, like the person who's shooting it is very tall. So you expect it to be a man. And I thought that was a very like sly thing to do, to sort of,
well, Mary Astor's pretty tall.
Yeah. Well, but she's not taller than, the guy who plays,
Miles.
The guy who plays Miles is Jerome Cowan, who is famous for being the lawyer in The Miracle on 34th Street. He's the prosecutor.
Okay.
The one who puts Santa Claus on trial, who needs to get his
how do you come back from that?
His kid a football at the end of the movie. But he's a tall guy. He's taller than Bogart. So I always thought that was interesting that like it's intentionally there to throw you off to make you think that it's a big person who shoots him.
Well, so, I mean, you assume that that's just the, because that scene transitions right into Bogart getting a call, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Never mind. My point, I was going to say that maybe it was like, I was confusing like the sequence of events.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things that I think is terrific about, John Huston's direction is that, that's the only moment I can think of where he tries to fool the audience in any way, shape, or form. Everything else he does in plain sight. So when he slips a Mickey into Sam Spade's drink, he does it like right on camera, but you're enthralled by Sidney Greenstreet and entertained by what he's saying. So you hardly notice.
Do you see him pocket $1,000 bill?
No, I think, I don't, at least, you know, but you also like, you see Wilmer, get out of the room before the big reveal that he's not there. He does it right on camera, mm-hmm. but because the dialogue keeps you invested in what's happening.
Well, he even walks right in front of the camera.
I think he ducks back behind Spade. So you see him like behind Spade leaving. You know, but they're talking and you're invested in what's going on and you're listening to what they're saying. And you like, it's just kind of less, it almost seems a subliminal thing, but like he shows it to you in plain sight.
It's because like the other characters, that's when the Falcon arrives. Right.
Yeah.
So like, you know, like everyone else, you see, O'Shaughnessy and Cairo crowding around as they're opening up the bundle.
Yeah. The Captain Jacoby, who was the captain of the, I think the ship's name is La Paloma. That's actually Walter Huston, John Huston's father, uncredited.
Want to kill his dad off screen.
Yeah. Well, he's actually the only director still in history to direct, a family member to an Oscar. So in Treasure of Sierra Madre, Walter Huston wins Best Supporting Actor, which was directed by John Huston. Mm. In fact, the Maltese Falcon has a lot in common with the Treasure of Sierra Madre because both of them are about a group of people who are obsessed with getting wealth in one way, shape, or form, and completely failing to do so.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, man.
Yeah. Try all you want.
And to be honest, he actually directs one of the quintessential heist movies of the noir genre, which is The Asphalt Jungle.
I've not seen that.
Yeah, same kind of thing, though. Like, it's about people who just don't get what they want. cool. Well, you enjoyed it. You would watch it again?
Yes, certainly.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, though, watching the movie made me want to watch just more Humphrey Bogart, though. Yeah. So, I think... I only own a couple of his movies, but I guess it's... I know the Warner Archive has updated a lot of his pictures onto Blu-ray.
Yeah. Well, you should check out Big Sleep. Although the Big Sleep, the story... And this is true of a lot of Chandler stuff. Is much more convoluted and tougher to follow. Hammett's book and Houston, of course, does a great job of keeping things simple. You can follow everything in the Maltese Falcon, like point by point by point. And like I mentioned, like hardly anything ever happens off screen. Whereas in like a lot of other detective fiction,
except someone getting shot.
Yeah. Well,
Jacoby dies.
Well, get shot. So does Thursby. Yeah. We don't see him get killed either, but they're superfluous. We don't, we never meet Thursby, so who cares? You know, we're only told about him, so then we're told he's dead, and it doesn't matter. Because the mystery becomes something different at that point. It takes a turn. But the Big Sleep, they're, like, by the end of the movie, I've seen that movie at least a half dozen times, and I still, like, couldn't tell you, like, everything that happens in the last act of that movie. It's just way too confusing. And so much stuff happens off screen that you're just like... Huh? What? But you don't care because it's really just about Bogart and Bacall by that point, you know. Obviously Treasure of Sierra Madre is a big one.
It's been a long time since I've seen that film.
African Queen's a big one. So I would definitely recommend High Sierra. You know, he's not a good guy in that movie, but he's the lead. Ida Lupina's in it. She's great. And it has a great, like, mountain standoff where he is, like, trapped and the law surrounds him.
The law.
It's very much like that moment in Hell or High Water,
I've not seen it.
Which is now a movie that I brought up in two separate podcasts.
Good.
Yeah. So I guess I like that one. Go see Hell or High Water.
Sounds like it. Oscar nominee, Hell or High Water.
Yeah. Yep. Best Picture nominee, Best Supporting Actor nominee, and with screenplay.
I didn't get a chance to watch the Oscars this year.
Oh, really? I don't think we talked about that. Oh, well.
Stuff was going on in my family that week, so. Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, hey, no. Awesome.
Yeah, so what are we talking about next? Baseball, right?
You get to pick.
Yeah, opening day is next week, so, next week.
Well, so. I recently watched, I won't say which one, but I recently watched one of my favorite baseball movies.
Okay. I haven't watched any of them yet this year.
So we can definitely do baseball movies.
Okay. I'm probably just going to watch two baseball films I've never seen before. So we'll see. So I just talk about it.
Okay. Well, I'll
talk at you.
I'll rewatch a few and I'll try to watch at least one that I've never seen. But I have one more that's one of my favorites that I'm definitely going to watch.
Okay.
So... It's a surprise, not saying what it is.
Okay, great.
So, guys, brush up on your baseball movies, and we'll be talking about those next time.
Yeah. One you've never seen.
Well, there's a bunch I haven't seen, but, you know, obviously, you know, being a former baseball player in rec leagues and high school and everything. I
was a former baseball player, too, in Pee Wee.
Oh, yeah? Sweet. What position did you play?
Third base.
Oh, yeah, me too. I bet I was better.
I bet you're an adult, too. I bet you're an adult, too.
I threw the ball around today, actually.
I don't give a shit.
All right, fine.
And not anymore after that slight. I want to play catch with DC today. We'll do it.
We're gonna play some verbal catch next week with some baseball movies.
Okay.
That's what we're going to do. I'm going to toss it back and forth. But now I'm going to toss it to
No errors.
To take us out.
Please stop. You got to save this for next week.
Oh, there'll be plenty of baseball puns next week.
Oh, man. I'm waiting for it. All right.
I thought you were going to take us out. All right. Where can people find you on the internet, Mr. Cesar?
I guess you could find me in multiple different places, but I'm primarily on filmsmash.com, Asian cinema reviews and news.
And check out the reviews for those two.
Chihaya Furu, verse 1, verse 2.
There you go. Check those. Those should be hitting over the next few days.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be out before this gets posted. So I'm sure that
I'm gonna race to get this posted.
The links will be at the bottom of the description. We'll see. Like I said, they're already drafted. They just need to hit the time for posting.
This is all inside baseball that the people don't need to know. All right. So, filmsmash.com, Asian news and reviews.
Where can people find you, CJ?
Wait, you're also on Twitter, right?
I am. I don't remember where.
At Junior Vigo.
Thanks.
I remember. And you can find me on Twitter at Setting the Frame. And for those of you who are on Facebook, we'll see you on the Celluloid Jelly forums.
Indeed.
And you can let us know what you think about this episode and any past or future episodes. If you have any comments, suggestions, or movie recommendations that you'd like us to do for a future episode, we're always up for that as well.
Yes.
So, all right, guys. Thank you so much. Cesar, thank you for joining me, as always.
Thanks for having me, CJ.
Yeah, no problem. Bye.
Goodbye.